Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring the stories that make the incredible world of tech and venture tick. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to the founders, investors, and ecosystem operators trying to make a dent in the future. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm super excited to have with me Sara Nadav. Sara is a founder, data storyteller, behavioral economist, investor, and author of the Amazon bestseller, What the Fuck Should I Do Now? How to Manage Your Money When Everything You Thought You Knew Stops Making Sense. A senior behavioral designer at Wix, Sara previously founded two fintech ventures, Bookit, a debt settlement platform for the distressed debt market, and Civilize, a platform addressing fraud in the secondary defaulted debt market, and provides ongoing expertise to the World Economic Forum as an expert network behavioral economist. Sara, it's so great to have you with me on the podcast today. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Amazing. So let's jump straight in. There's a lot to unpack just from that intro. I'd love for you to share a little bit more about your journey from founding through Techstars to the World Economic Forum and beyond.
Yeah, so my story starts during the mortgage crisis in 2008 and a friend of mine who bought back his own mortgage. So he had a $20 million mortgage, which he bought back for, I believe, $2 million. And he was explaining to me how he did that. And his bank was failing, put the mortgage up for sale. And then he bought his own loan and essentially would be paying himself back, but really just got, 90% off of his debt. And I was fascinated. I was hooked. It felt like magic. How did this happen? And from that moment, I got kind of, obsessed with this market problem happening in the secondary defaulted debt market. Because you have, on one hand, a debt where most products will go down in value when it goes down to a wholesaler. But with debt, it goes up because of interest and fees. And that is a really huge problem for consumers because they find themselves in a position where the interest and fees make it almost impossible for them to pay back their debts if it's, twice, three times as much as they borrowed. So I wanted to solve that problem, which is why I created my first company, Bookit. That ended up kind of not working out due to the enormity of the market itself. We had $5 billion of portfolios within the market, but it was a $3 trillion market. In my second company, Civilize, we pivoted to more of a consumer-facing approach, which was when I got into Techstars. So I learned an incredible amount. They really pack a lot into a short amount of time. But with that startup, we were based on regulations and laws that Trump began repealing right as we were finishing up Techstars. And that was a huge hurdle. And my co-founder and I had made a commitment to each other to fail fast. And we didn't see the regulatory issues as something we could overcome. So we moved on. But my takeaway from that time was, along with the behavioral and cognitive science that I started with, I got a deep insight into the workings of finance. I married those two together, which is how my career evolved into being a behavioral economist. And when I was presenting Bookit, actually, there was a member of the World Economic Forum in the audience at a large presentation that I did, who invited me to join the MENA region in Jordan for an event, which I was so excited to attend. And then I really fell in love with the forum and all the opportunities and the incredible amount to learn. And over the years, participated to the point where I was accepted into their expert network.
Amazing. So it sounds like you kind of married, as you say, that love for finance along with kind of this I don't know what you would call it, but this like, you know, desire to, you know, solve, you know, these big problems that kind of led you into the World Economic Forum. I mean, can you explain a little bit about what it is that an expert network behavioral economist actually does?
Yeah. So the forum brings together politicians, entrepreneurs or leaders of business, and thinkers, academics. And I would be in the category of the thinkers and academics. And what the World Economic Forum kind of does is bring all these different people together for serendipity and to inform each other and to make connections and to work together and to facilitate a kind of stakeholder economy where people are all talking to each other. So I contribute by contributing my expertise within the network, joining into different groups that they're holding, seminars that they do, sharing articles, data, information, and then it's distributed within the forum.
Amazing. I mean, the word that I love there is serendipity. It's one that I use all the time. And I think exactly as you describe, the more people talk and the more people understand kind of the cut and thrust of different views, the more we hone in on an understanding of a particular subject matter. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have to come to a complete agreement, I guess, right? But it allows, you know, it allows governments, politicians, economists, you know, the world, you know, leaders to find a path forward, which is a compromise between maybe two very, very sort of binary options on you know, if left otherwise alone. I'd love to talk for a minute about your book. Do you think that we're slipping further down a slope of mass consumerism, credit, buy now, pay later, sort of self-delusion that is only going to end in tears? What behaviors change or are forcing change on individuals now, especially post-pandemic and now obviously with the war, ongoing war in Ukraine? How do you think your books can help navigate some of those problems that individuals are facing?
So my book is not for everyone. My book is very specific for people in financial crisis. I see, yes, I actually think this will end in tears on some of the other issues that you mentioned, but I don't blame consumers. I'm an economist. I blame an era of planned obsolescence for items and inflation and the creation of financial products, the derivative markets, the billionaire class, and inequality. So I'll just put that out there. My book is based on reverse engineering the experiences that I saw of people who had a crisis, which was usually job loss, a marital crisis like divorce or an illness. At that moment of crisis, they had financial decisions that they need to make. It was very clear to me the different paths that people chose and the results that came for it. So when I say this isn't for everyone, not everyone is going to be in a crisis right now. But for those who are, you know, my message in the book is really that you need to do a kind of radical downsizing, and you really have to approach the shame that some people have about finances and just say, fuck it. You know, go for every scholarship, go for welfare, go for every government program, sell your house, do whatever it is that you possibly can. And the worst situations that I saw were people who carried a lot of shame, hid their financial problems, tried to maintain their life as it was, and they spiraled into bankruptcy, essentially. So I really believe in accepting the situation for it is, removing all the shame and making drastic changes, knowing that if you do that, your chances of bouncing back are phenomenal. and to have a positive point of view. And also, I guess the only thing that I think really applies to everybody right now, especially in the face of inflation, is it's just very important to own your life. So own your car, try to live in a house that you could own if possible. And not to worry about taking out debt in order to pay for it, because as inflation hits us, money becomes less valuable and your debt actually could be less of a problem.
So there were a couple of things in what you said there, which I think are really poignant. One is this this concept of shame, I think, and a lot of people hold on to that shame for a number of reasons. I think, you know, certainly the community that I come from and other communities that I know around me, there are huge amounts of shame attached to, you know, what job you have, or whether you have the right job, whether you have the right car, the right house in the right suburbs, are living the right life, if your kids are going to the right school. And, you know, a lot of people, I think, hide the level of indebtedness that they're in, or hide the kind of level of pain that they may be feeling, because they are, you know, they are ashamed, as you say. I wonder whether there needs to be kind of a little bit of a societal shift, right? Like, I talk about it a lot in terms of entrepreneurship, in that, you know, in the US, there is no shame around creating a business and then failing. And you talked about it earlier, you know, you and your co-founder had said, if you're going to fail, you want it to fail fast. Whereas in the UK, and other regions for sure, we have a very, very different attitude, I think, towards that. And I think, you know, failure in business is seen as a personal failure, and personal failure is the last thing, you know, that anyone wants to get through. So how can we, I mean, I think it's absolutely very positive to be reinforcing this message to people that, you know, they should take control of their lives and downsize and do whatever's necessary. But how can one rid themselves of that shame? And how can we also make, you know, society more accepting of the fact that there are vulnerable people out there? And even those that look like they came from a place of strength have vulnerabilities that, you know, are maybe completely debilitating.
I think it takes an incredible amount of courage, and I would not for a second minimize how difficult it is to, you know, stand in your truth when your truth is, you know, that everything is falling apart. The more people do it, the more it will, you know, become normalized. But I also think, you know, people do get locked into their home, their neighborhood, their job, their schools, their lifestyle, and they forget all the other homes, jobs, schools, lifestyles that exist as options and could perhaps be far more modest, but equally as good in terms of quality of life. And I tried to work with people to really understand that the consequences of not taking that step, of that courageous step, they're dire. It's bankruptcy, it's suicide, it's alcoholism, you know, it's marriages that crumble. You know, I think it needs to be placed in the perspective of keeping up appearances can be an exceptionally high price that, you know, ultimately can't possibly be worth it.
Yeah, I think the keeping up with the Joneses, keeping up experiences, etc., I think is it's a road to nowhere, right? It's that kind of rat race treadmill kind of concept of spinning your wheels but never actually getting anywhere. And I think it's actually quite liberating once you unshackle yourself from that treadmill, because I mean, I realized quite late in life, I would say that, you know, actually, there is no issue with not having the biggest car or the biggest house or having the job that others, you know, might have aspired to. Because actually, you know, I found a lot of value in having time, which has allowed me to actually create two businesses and create this podcast and spend time doing things that I really enjoy doing. But I think, you know, it comes back. So much of what you just said comes back to the first thing you said, which was, you know, it requires courage. And I think that courage has to come, you know, from within us, but then also, you know, courage and support from those around us. So you have another book in the works with a publishing deal from Time Magazine. Could you tell us a little bit about the direction that that's going to go in?
Yeah, so that is actually a licensing deal with The Next Advisor, which is Time Magazine's financial advice magazine. I'm working on the book right now. It has ended up being a continuation. When I wrote the first book, it was during the first lockdown, and I thought to myself, you know, we don't know what's coming. We don't know what levels of urgency and crisis people are going to need. And I felt this also was the time that this book needed to be written and published, because I had wanted to do it since 2017. But in that time, in rereading my book, it's interesting, but it's not, we've evolved. You know, we have vaccines, we understand COVID, we see what it's done to the economy, how things have changed. And there's more material, in a sense, to work with. And the landscape has changed. What we're worried about is changing. Like, now I really believe, you know, protecting yourself from inflation is a, you know, a top priority. Other issues that weren't included in the first book that I really want to touch on.
Amazing. I can't wait to pick it up when it's released. So look, whilst I didn't mention this in your intro, you are very openly vocal about the fact that you are neurodivergent, though diagnosed quite late in life. And it strikes me that there are likely quite a lot of neurodiverse people in the tech and venture ecosystem. How do you use this superpower when you're looking at new investments? And I appreciate that you aren't necessarily a professional investor right now, but it'd be great to get your perspective.
Yeah. So neurodivergent is very different across people, but there are a lot of people in tech who are neurodivergent. So I feel, you know, like that's a kind of good combination. It's been an absolute superpower for me in a few ways. One is I have an ability to see patterns and approach problem solving in a way that's not linear. I kind of see problems in my head, somewhat similar to the girl playing chess in the Queen's Gambit. And I move the pieces of the problem around in my mind until solutions come together. And I will literally think about asset classes as a way to relax at night before bed. I find it really soothing. So when companies come to me with interesting problems, I will kind of put that into my mind. I will move the pieces of the problem around. I will be approaching that in my spare time or in the evenings. And kind of if I get epiphanies, if questions or ideas, and I get excited about how this is coming together, I feel like that's really a strong signal that this company is doing something great. Another way is that I get kind of hyper fixation, which is a gift, really, in the sense that, you know, I really enjoy thinking. So once I get my teeth into something, my world gets really narrow and I dive in and I can acquire some pretty deep knowledge pretty fast. And that also really just helps me weed out companies that I don't think are serious. Because if I feel like I can learn or know more than they do about their own industry, for example, like I know it's a hard pass. And I think finally that I don't find storytelling very compelling. It doesn't mean much to me, and I'm not interested in founders so much for who they are or any kind of cult or personality. It's not that I don't care about founders, because I do, and I love to mentor founders. It just means I'm not swayed by charisma. I look for entrepreneurs who I consider to be overperformers, and they need to have a credible business. And in that way, it just prevents a lot of bias. I see too many investors who are looking for founders they like, founders they see that they could be friends with or trapped on a deserted island with. But I just see potential business partners, and it's very, very straightforward to me.
So I'm going to have to dig into that, because this is a really interesting take on this podcast. So up until now, and I've said this time and time again, pretty much every investor that we've spoken to has said, you know, the founder and the founding team are the most important thing. They haven't necessarily gone into kind of a depth of explanation, but it's often around, you know, what have they done? Are they able to attract, you know, great team members around them, which obviously goes to your point around charisma and storytelling. Are they able to raise additional funds from other, you know, from other investors down the track, etc. Whereas what you're saying is actually, no, if you strip away all the, you know, all the performative side of being a founder, actually what you're left with is this person capable of executing on a great business? And that's what you're indexing for. Is that correct? And I guess the other sort of part of that is, you know, you've done a lot of mentorship with Google Campus out in Israel. I mean, you know, how do you sort of select those businesses, or, you know, what happens if you are presented with a business that doesn't fit that kind of, you know, excitement and real sort of growth potential that you described earlier?
So I actually do look at who the founder is in terms of, are they capable of getting other people on board? And do I think they're going to be successful, or, you know, is their personality something that will be an asset to them, or, you know, but I just don't feel the personal need to be their friend. And that's what I think actually creates a lot of bias. If you're looking for friends, you know, I don't know, go to a bar. I don't see why you need to be friends with founders, because plenty of people you might not want to hang out with are really incredible business people. And especially for, you know, people who are for women or overlooked founders, people of color, people from different cultures. So they're not as relatable. So it's not that I don't look at people for who they are. I take a more objective look, and I don't need to be so relatable, because it's just not where my head is at. I just want to say one more thing, that all of these VCs who are picking founders according to like personality are creating a really unsustainable venture structure that shuts out most of the best founders. And I don't think they're doing a very good job, to be honest, at picking who's going to be successful. So that's that.
We've just had the recent kind of, you know, news that one of these companies, I think it's Fast, you know, is burning $10 million a month on $600,000 annual revenue. And, you know, people are rightly asking the question, well, you know, who funded that? How was it funded? And how, you know, how did you let them perpetrate this on such an ongoing basis? And we all know the stories of some of these founders who have had, you know, very negative traits, whether that's, you know, WeWork, whether that's Uber, et cetera. And I would imagine that, as you say, right, it creates this sort of unsustainable ecosystem, because again, it's also investors funding people who look like them and talk like them and feel like them, right? And again, it therefore means that you are not participating in the vast majority of the world that doesn't look or feel or sound like you, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of, like, you know, the WeWork story is about people who got sucked into this guy's storytelling and his personality. They weren't objective.
Yeah, I think including himself is probably the best way of thinking about it as well. He sort of drank his own Kool-Aid. But look, just as we kind of come to a close, this pod is all about the entrepreneurial spirit. You founded two ventures. You've mentored over 150 startups through Google Campus in Tel Aviv. And, you know, we've talked to a number of people on the pod about some of the unique attributes of the Israeli ecosystem. For you, and you talked about it, you know, in terms of what you're you know, the fact that you don't want to look at the personality as much, but what are the actual attributes that you think make an incredible entrepreneur? And are there traits equally that you've seen that tell you an individual may have trouble going down the entrepreneurial path?
Yeah. So as a behavioral economist, I can't help but observe people and analyze them through that lens. From that perspective, I think there are two kinds of founders that can be very successful, and they often go best as a team because it makes a very optimal match of personalities. I'm not saying either one of these can't succeed without the other, but when you have it together, it's kind of magic. So the most incredible entrepreneurs to me are geniuses who are obsessed with their work and solving a problem. But also, those same people really need to be even-tempered. They have to know how to stay calm, remain calm, and have perspective. And I see that those people, and I can say anybody within the industry who really just keeps their perspective, stays calm, and can keep a balance will go very far. Because even if you're a genius, if you don't have the emotional balance, you know, there's so much pressure in the startup world, it can be very explosive. So those people tend to fall apart and it can be very unpredictable. And as a match for that, and it irritates me so much to say this, right? But I do think these big personality people can go very far. People who have kind of bulletproof egos and a lot of audacity and no fucks to give. You know, when they're partnered with somebody who has an extremely good idea and they can amplify that and they can, you know, kind of make that happen. And also, you know, ideally be humble, be calm, and keep their head about them. This is, you know, perfect. You know, it's even keeled, and you know, it takes the journey from being a roller coaster to being, you know, more of a straight ride. So there's a little bit of a, you know, there are problems in that dynamic also. And it's not that I don't think single founders can do amazing jobs, because they absolutely can. It's just extremely difficult. Extremely difficult to go through all of that on your own. I also feel like the best people are not the people who want to be an entrepreneur. It's the people who do it because there is no other way of life. They are passionate because there are easier ways to make money than founding, you know, being a founder. One last thing I think I'll throw in is people, I guess it goes along with the even keel, people who don't take things too personally, because you do have to get literally hundreds, maybe thousands of no's in order to get the yeses that you need. So it takes stamina. And that's what I look for.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. What you said at the end there, not just not taking things personally in terms of kind of the no's that you get, but equally not wrapping yourself up and intertwining yourself with your business, I think is a really key part of being a great entrepreneur, because there will be times where you're going to struggle, you know, to make payroll, to make payments. There will be times where, you know, customers are going to complain, or a client kind of, you know, is not happy with the service that they've received. And I think it's massively important for a founder to be able to have the objectivity to sort of stand outside of themselves or step away from the business and say, okay, well, that's fine. Okay, objectively, this is what's happened. This is the problem. This is how I'm going to solve it. But I'm not going to, you know, become emotionally entangled in the problem, or allow it to kind of cause me to disrupt my life in terms of, you know, my emotional life, because that can be very, very destructive. And I've been there, and I've seen, you know, other founders who've been there as well. And it is a really, really dark kind of place to be. And I think the great thing at the moment is certainly post COVID, but even sort of before then, I think there's been a lot more light being shone on advocacy for, you know, for mental health within the entrepreneurial kind of ecosystem. And I think that is massively important. And I think the second thing that you said there, you know, the first thing effectively that you said, but, you know, around having that great founding team, again, I think that's something I would definitely agree with. I think there is for more mature founders who have had a bit more sort of life experience, they may have maybe able to kind of sit on both sides of that table, be both the visionary as well as the kind of calm, even keeled person. But I absolutely do agree that, you know, with almost any venture that I look at, like, you need to have someone who can drive the purpose and the passion. And whether they are a co-founder or not, you also need someone to run the business. And often those things, you know, are not compatible within one individual.
It's very, very hard to be all of that, you know, at one time. Very hard. Because it's a full-time job. The CEOing, where you're having meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting, you know, if you want to get any progress or work done, I don't even know how you would actually carve that out. It's incompatible, in my opinion.
Well, speaking from my own experience, I definitely agree with that. So Sara, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here with me on the podcast today. For our listeners, where's the best place for them to find you? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where's the best place for them to look for you online?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. But if you want to reach out, definitely find me on Twitter. I love meeting new people and connecting. So find me on Twitter.
Amazing. Sara, thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful. Have a great day ahead.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. Follow us on social and at nothingventured.tech to make sure you never miss another episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. We love to hear from our listeners to understand the topics and guests that they'd like to hear about and from most. Drop us a message via the links in the show notes, and thanks again for your support.